Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with a report from the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees that finds the majority of children from Central America heading to the United States that they interviewed qualify as refugees, not migrants. Jenna Mason, a senior advisor for government relations and external affairs at the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, where she represents the UNHCR's interests with the United States government, joins us to discuss the definitions and criteria that determine who is a refugee and who is a migrant. Then we will speak with Ruthie Epstein, an immigration policy analyst and lobbyist at the American Civil Liberties Union, who has an article in Wednesday's New York Times, Show Fairness and Due Process. We will discuss the extent to which the humanitarian crisis on our southern border has become a political football and whether the U.S. will stick to its obligations under existing law or cave into pressure to streamline deportations by doing away with due process. Then finally, we will discuss the deepening crisis in Iraq and the intensifying military action between Israel and Hamas that could soon lead to a ground invasion of Gaza. Juan Cole, professor of modern Middle Eastern and South Asian history at the University of Michigan and author of the new book, The New Arabs, How the Millennial Generation is Changing the Middle East, joins us to discuss the future of the generation that brought about the Arab Spring and whether Middle Eastern governments are now more worried about internal stability than supporting external instability through proxies like Hamas. Joining us now is Jenna Mason, who is a senior advisor for government relations and external affairs at the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees in Washington, D.C., where she represents the agency's interests with the United States government, particularly the State Department and Congress, and with non-governmental organizations. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jenna Mason.
Thank you very much.
And the UNHCR have done a report on the Central American refugee children coming into the United States. I believe they interviewed 404 children in Central America. And the basic findings, I take it, are that the UN thinks that the United States and Mexico should reclassify these children not as migrants but as refugees.
Well, for some of them, that's a distinct possibility. What we're basically saying is that we recognize that the migration from Central America right now is a very complex phenomenon. It's what we tend to refer to as a mixed migration. People are leaving Central America for a wide variety of reasons, some of them for reasons of the abject poverty that's down there in those countries, some of them because of violence. There's widespread violence of varying nature. There's gang-related violence. Of course, there are the drug cartels. There's a breakdown of law and order. So some people are fleeing violence, definitely. Some of them, particularly children, unfortunately, are being trafficked. They're victims of trafficking. And some people are leaving to join family members. So within this complex phenomenon and mixed migration, some of those children very definitely have a fear of persecution or a fear of serious harm in their home countries, and they're the ones that we believe should have access to asylum procedures and may very well qualify for refugee status.
And so the United States has various laws that would categorize these children as refugees under asylum. There's also, of course, the William Wilberforce law that George W. Bush signed that is about human trafficking. You mentioned that as an aspect, too. You know, at this moment, the United States government, the Congress and both the White House are thinking about reconsidering the William Wilberforce trafficking statute simply because of the flood. That means that the children would not be interviewed by somebody from Health and Human Services, but rather by somebody from the Border Patrol. So already it does seem that this situation on the border is forcing the United States to sort of back away from some of its legal responsibilities in law. So walk us through these categories and where are the holes?
Absolutely. Well, as you mentioned, the U.S. has one obligation under refugee law, and it's its own law. In 1980, the U.S. Enacted a law called the Refugee Act of 1980, and that defines a refugee under U.S. law. The definition of a refugee under that law is almost identical to the international definition that we use in UNHCR, which is found in a 1951 convention on refugees. The U.S. basically adopted that definition, which defines a refugee as someone outside their home country who fears persecution. And there are very specific grounds on which you have to fear persecution. If you meet that definition, you could be considered a refugee. While your case is pending, you're called an asylum seeker. So that's what those terms mean. Now, the trafficking law that you referred to is another obligation that the U.S. has undertaken, which specifically applies to individuals, including children, who could be victims of trafficking. There's also a torture convention that prohibits the forced return of people if they could fear torture upon being returned to their home country. So there are a lot of obligations. The one that my agency deals with is the obligation not to send refugees or potential refugees back home. So it's unfortunate that there's any debate going on that could cause any retrenchment from these obligations. I don't believe the U.S. government is going to do that. The U.S. officials that are responsible for these programs are very aware of and very dedicated to their legal obligations, both towards refugees and trafficking victims and torture victims. It's unfortunate that there are some calls out there to change those laws or back away from them, because these are really fundamental obligations that really are consistent with the U.S. history as a beacon of hope for people that are fleeing persecution.
But the last category that you mentioned, refugees being returned, is there any clarity here in terms of there's a number of factors that you've just mentioned? There's torture, there is the human trafficking aspect, there's political asylum, and I take it the last category that you mentioned is that people are returning back to the conditions from which they fled, and therefore their lives are in danger. So,
well, the last category, political asylum, that's a category that basically is the refugee category. If people make it to the U.S. and they fear persecution if returned to their home country, they apply to the U.S. government and they're given the status of refugee. The U.S. government also has a program whereby they identify refugees overseas. In refugee camps or urban areas, and there's a 70,000 ceiling every year under which the U.S. admits refugees directly to the U.S. But the parallel program is for people who arrive in the U.S. On U.S. shores, and they seek asylum because they fear that protection. Both of them are subject to the same definition, the same standard of being a refugee. The only difference is whether you apply from overseas or in the U.S., on U.S. territory.
Again, I'm speaking with Jana Mason, who's a senior advisor for government relations and external affairs at the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees in Washington, D.C., where she represents the agency's interests with the United States government, particularly the State Department and Congress, and with non-governmental organizations. So the asylum statute or the status is one thing, then the refugee status another. So how, for example, could these, and I believe that a lot of these children are coming from one particular town in El Salvador that's particularly violent. It's overrun by drug gangs, many of them here from Southern California who kind of recycled in and out, the MS-13 gang, for example. My understanding of asylum would be, at least my assumption is that refers to political regimes that are repressive as opposed to non-governmental actors like street gangs. So how do you make that distinction?
Absolutely. That's a great question, and I wish that there were more understanding of that in this debate. The five grounds of persecution that I referred to earlier are race, religion, nationality, which also means ethnic background, political opinion, or membership in a particular social group. And it's this last ground, social group, that is the most flexible and has, over the years, allowed the inclusion of a lot of different individuals. It could be persons who are homosexual and are being persecuted, or women from Muslim countries who don't want to wear the veil, or young men who don't want to be conscripted into the armed forces. This determination of what constitutes a social group has been determined through case law by the courts over the years. So in the case of gang violence, you were just mentioning, and lawlessness, They're very, in many cases, and some of the stories we heard from the kids, there could be a link to one of these five grounds. For example, we heard stories of young women who were raped because their boyfriend wouldn't join a gang. Now, this may seem like, something that's not related, but it doesn't have to be the government that's persecuting you to qualify you for refugee status. It could be what we call non-state actors if the government is not able to protect you. And one of the things that all the children we interviewed told us is that they just, whatever the source of the violence, they didn't fear that their country could protect them. We know in Central America there are a lot of complex things going on. As you mentioned, gangs. Sometimes there's a political element to this. Sometimes there's a class element to who is persecuted or who is expected to join a gang or not. So many times there is a link between one of these five grounds and the fact that they're being targeted by a gang or by a criminal element, or sometimes even by some other armed actor. And you really have to get into the facts of each case. And the only ones who are in the position to do that are the U.S. government officials who will be interviewing them and making this case-by-case determination. And that's what we're asking for. Just give these kids a chance to tell their story and let the U.S. officials make that determination.
So, but the U.S. officials, for example, apparently interviewed the Sanarif brothers, who were responsible for the Boston Marathon bombing. They claimed political asylum from Chechnya. So they obviously slipped through the cracks. Is there any evidence, for example, that there's a bias towards those coming from Central and South America?
I don't think so. I think the refugee definition, the asylum adjudicators that do it domestically and the refugee adjudicators that do it overseas are trained very well and are applying the same standards. Often, over the years, obviously, situations change in different regions of the world. There was a time when individuals from Central America had very high recognition rates in terms of asylum claims. There were times when Eastern Europe was a source of a lot of asylum seekers, and those claims were being heard, and they were being admitted to the U.S. Right now, of course, parts of the Middle East and Asia are seeing large numbers of refugees and asylum seekers. So if you look by category, by nationality, in the DHS, approval rates, I think you'll see that there are people from all over the world who are recognized, and it really goes not so much to the country, but to the nature of the claim.
But how do we differentiate? I mean, here we have a situation where the United States government is helping the UNHCR deal with the refugees from Syria, many of whom are in Jordan, which is already a fairly frail country to begin with in terms of its infrastructure and its ability to deal with this enormous influx of refugees. At the same time, the UNHCR, via the report that you've done, is now suggesting that this flood of children are also refugees. Every day, almost, it seems, in the Mediterranean, bodies are floating around from Africans coming from the continent of Africa trying to get into Europe. Obviously, for a better life. So where are the lines drawn then in terms of so many people in the third world obviously have both economic and political problems of one sort or another, and the first world is obviously very attractive. So it seems to me that the definitions do seem slightly elastic here in terms of who's an economic refugee and who's a political refugee.
Yeah, we would argue that who's an economic refugee is fairly clear-cut. If there is no persecution on one of these five grounds, now again, there could be a torture claim or trafficking, but people fleeing purely for economic reasons wouldn't fit into one of those grounds and wouldn't be protected, and then they would be subject to normal deportation procedures. And we fully understand that among these children from Central America, probably a significant number won't meet the refugee definition, and again, they will be subject to deportation. We would certainly hope that would be done in a humane manner, but that's where our agency would no longer have a mandate for the for these people. But it's interesting you mentioned Syria. Syria right now has produced 3 million refugees, most of them in Jordan, Lebanon, other countries in the region. Like that population, most of the world's refugees are coming from developing countries and they're in developing countries. I mean, Lebanon had a population of 4 million before the Syrian crisis. Now they have over 1 million Syrians. So their population has increased by 25% because of this. If you look at the numbers coming into the U.S., that really pales in comparison. Most of the refugee burden, if you will, is really being shouldered by the developing world. The U.S. does its part by admitting some refugees from overseas, like I said, about 70,000 a year, and granting asylum to smaller numbers. I think in recent years the U.S. has granted asylum, this is for people who come to the U.S. and apply, to about 30,000 people or a little bit less than 30,000 a year, and this is from all over the world as well. So a combined total of about 100,000 a year get refugee status in the U.S. through these two programs, compared with, again, 1 million Syrians currently in Lebanon, and 700,000 or so in Jordan, about an equal number in Turkey, and then around the continent of Africa, they're all hosting hundreds of thousands of refugees as well. So this is how the U.S. meets its obligation. It's definitely a leader in doing so, but again, we do acknowledge that those who don't qualify are subject to being returned home, and we're only calling for a recognition that some of them. Some number among them could be refugees, and we want them to get a chance to tell their story and have their claims heard.
So, Jenna Mason, if poverty, which it clearly is life-threatening to so many people in the third world, what is the distinction between fleeing from life-threatening poverty than fleeing from some abuses of some dictator?
Yeah, absolutely. When the Refugee Convention was adopted in 1951, and again, that definition is what the U.S. law is based on as well, there was a recognition that there are certain elements of harm, certain elements of persecution that I guess are just so abhorrent to international norms that people suffering that type of persecution needed to be particularly protected. And again, the convention was adopted in the wake of World War II to help resolve the issue of World War II refugees. Obviously, the situation did not go away. The world continued producing many more refugees from all different continents for all different reasons. But if you look at those five grounds that I mentioned, being persecuted because of your religion, because of your political beliefs, because of your ethnic background, these are things that we feel are categories of people that really, really need special international protection. Now, people fleeing poverty, obviously that's a serious issue, and that's dealt with largely by the development agencies. The UN has there's an agency called the UN Development Program. The U.S. government has an agency for international development. These are agencies that are particularly mandated to focus on poverty alleviation, poverty reduction, and trying to help people make a better life who are fleeing those type of conditions.
Well, Jenna Mason, I thank you very much for joining us here today. And how can people get hold of your report on the Central American refugees that suggests that they're not so much migrants as refugees?
If they go to UNHCR.org, which is our central website, and just type in Children on the Run, or just Google UNHCR Children on the Run, that's the name of our report.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you. A pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Jenna Mason, who's a senior advisor for government relations and external affairs at the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees in Washington, D.C., where she represents the agency's interests with the United States government, particularly the State Department and Congress, and with non-governmental organizations. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into whether the United States will cave into pressure to streamline deportations by doing away with due process.
There's a place where I've been told Every street is paved with gold, and it's just across the border line.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Ruthie Epstein, who is an immigration policy analyst and lobbyist at the American Civil Liberties Union. She has an article in Wednesday's New York Times, Show Fairness and Due Process. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ruthie Epstein.
Thank you very much.
And obviously, this humanitarian crisis on the border has become a political football. You've got the governor of Texas saying darkly that Obama is, this is all some conspiracy, but he failed to explain what possible political advantage Obama could be getting out of this. Even a Democratic congressman from Texas is complaining that Obama's having a beer in a bar in Colorado and not down on the border. This is clearly not a win for Obama, certainly not a win for the children. What's your sense of how this can be resolved, given that politics seem to have trumped humanitarian responsibilities?
I'm glad that you're highlighting the politicization of this issue, which is incredibly unfortunate. What it is a humanitarian crisis that we're seeing at the border. And it's a crisis because, number one, these kids, who number since last October around 52,000, are fleeing incredible violence and danger in their home countries. Three-quarters of them have come from Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador. And the other piece of the crisis is that the U.S. government was not prepared to handle the scale of arrivals that we're seeing. So they weren't prepared with the amount of space that they need, the amount of adjudication resources that they need to process the kids and the families who are being apprehended right now by Customs and Border Protection. But the politicization of this issue and the conflation with immigration reform has turned into a real barrier for the administration and for Congress to deal responsibly with the issue. What we think the administration needs to do, number one, is increase funding for Health and Human Services, which is responsible for the care and custody of these kids. And that is indeed what the emergency supplemental request submitted yesterday would do. But the other piece that's crucial is that the administration and Congress invest in adequate adjudication resources, which means more immigration judges, more asylum officers to assess the asylum claims of these kids and the families who are being apprehended to ensure that they have access to protection in the United States.
Well, already there's some indications that the law under which these children are afforded a counsel, or at least an interview, by the Department of Health and Human Services is this William Wilberforce law passed during the George W. Bush administration that deals with human trafficking. That, apparently, there's a lot of pressure on the White House to even circumvent that and just have these children interviewed by the Border Patrol instead. So where does that issue stand?
Yeah, that proposal is a tremendous disappointment to anyone who cares about due process and protection for people seeking safety in this country. The law that you're referring to is known as the TVPRA. It's the Trafficking Victims Protection Reauthorization Act of 2008. It was a bipartisan bill. As you mentioned, it was signed by President Bush in 2008. And what that law does is ensure that children who are coming to the United States from non-contiguous countries, so any country that's not Mexico or Canada, that they have the opportunity to assert a claim to asylum and to make their claim in front of an immigration judge. And so what folks are proposing right now, both in Congress and unfortunately in the White House, would be to curtail dramatically those protections for the kids coming specifically from Central America. And as you say, designate Border Patrol to be the sole screening authority to determine whether kids have valid asylum claims. And that's a huge problem. That hasn't worked for the unaccompanied Mexican children for whom that procedure currently applies, and it should not be extended to the kids arriving now from El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras.
Well, as you know, Ruthie Epstein, the UNHCR have issued a report suggesting that these children be called refugees, not migrants, and changing the entire definition and using the argument, and apparently they interviewed 404 children from Central America, and this report is both directed at the United States and at Mexico to reclassify these children as refugees as opposed to migrants. What is your response to that report?
That's exactly right that you raised that. So UNHCR is the United Nations Refugee Agency. They have their concern is refugee protection for people worldwide. And they conducted a study last year that's written about in this report that was released in March, in which they found that 58%, almost 60% of kids from Guatemala, Honduras, El Salvador, and Mexico coming to the United States cited violence in their home countries as one key reason that they fled their home countries. So what UNHCR has urged... Sorry, that's the World Cup in the background. What UNHCR has urged is that the United States ensure that kids who are arriving from those countries right now have access to the U.S. asylum system because, indeed, they may have valid asylum claims. This is extremely important, and the thing to keep in mind is that the U.S. does have an asylum system designed to deal with exactly this type of situation. And every child needs to have access to that asylum system so that their case can be assessed individually.
Again, I'm speaking with Ruthie Epstein, who is an immigration policy analyst and lobbyist at the American Civil Liberties Union. She has an article in Wednesday's New York Times show Fairness and Due Process. So how do you, though, make that distinction? Obviously, we're talking about definitions here. The UNHCR is saying these children are not migrants, they're refugees. The United States is saying, no, they're migrants, and the protections under our laws now are being questioned, you know, obviously because of the sheer volume. And, you know, all around the world you have people regularly drowning in the Mediterranean, coming in from North Africa, trying to get into Italy and Spain, etc. So arguably, most people that are going from the third world to the first world or even the second world are escaping some kind of violence, if not economic misery. I mean, that's pervasive around the world. So where do you make this distinction in law so that we're not sort of the definitions aren't vague?
Yeah, these are important philosophical questions that you're raising, really, about to whom does a country like the United States owe obligations? And the United States' obligations to people fleeing persecution in their home country are spelled out in asylum law, which is part of immigration law that's been debated over the course of the past year. A person who is seeking asylum in this country legally is asserting that they fear persecution in their home countries or have fled persecution in their home countries for one or more of the following grounds: race, religion, nationality, political opinion, and social group. So anyone coming to this country making a claim for asylum, asking for protection in the United States, with the help of an attorney, ideally, would be making a legal claim according to the law that's already articulated in the immigration law. The immigration law is extremely complicated in the United States. It's been compared to family law and tax law in its complexity, and that's why it's so important that kids and adults who are seeking to make a claim for legal relief in the United States have access to an attorney. Right now, they don't. Unfortunately.
So do you think then this report is going to shame the United States government in terms of this is the United Nations, this is a global problem, and the U.S. on the one hand is trying to take care of refugees in Syria, or actually in Jordan and other countries fleeing Syria, at the same time trying to turn back refugees from Central America?
Sorry, could you repeat the last part of your question? You were cutting in and out.
Sure. Will this UNHCR report, do you think, in any way embarrass the United States government? After all, the United States government is taking care of, through the UNHCR, refugees from Syria, particularly in Jordan, and at the same time appears to be trying to figure out ways to turn back refugees from Central America on our southern border. So, you know, that seems to be a bit of a inconsistency.
Indeed. The U.S. government, unfortunately, has persisted in using the language of stemming the tide, returning people to their home countries to send a message, this sort of language that is really contrary to the spirit of our obligations under international refugee law, under international human rights law. The United States needs to commit to ensuring that every child who's being apprehended at the border right now have access to an immigration court hearing in front of an immigration judge. And if the government cannot pull that off, then indeed they'll be undermining their global leadership on refugee protection. You're exactly right.
I thank you very much for joining us, Ruthie Epstein.
Thank you, Ian. Take care.
Again, I've been speaking with Ruthie Epstein, who is an immigration policy analyst and lobbyist at the American Civil Liberties Union. She has an article in Wednesday's New York Times, Show Fairness and Due Process. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back talking about whether Middle Eastern governments are now more worried about internal stability than supporting external instability through proxies like Hamas. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Juan Cole, a professor of modern Middle Eastern and South Asian history at the University of Michigan and president of the Global Americana Institute. He's the author of Sacred Space and Holy War, The Ayatollahs and Democracy in Iraq. And his latest book just out is The New Arabs, How the Millennial Generation is Changing the Middle East. He's also the author of the blog Informed Comment at juancole.com. Welcome to Background Briefing, Juan Cole.
Thank you, Ian.
And just as Iraq's falling apart, now we have, of course, the distraction, if you will, going on between Israel and Hamas, with Hamas rockets raining down on Israel and a ground invasion about to happen at any moment. So what's going on in Hamas or what's going on in Iraq, equally depressing, Juan. I guess choose your poison. Where do we want to start?
Well, it seems to me that both of these crises, as well as the one in Afghanistan, are rooted in the policies of the Bush administration. In 2006, the Palestine Authority had a round of parliamentary elections, and unexpectedly, Hamas won them. The Israelis had not wanted Hamas to be allowed to run. The Bush administration insisted that it must be allowed to run. But then when it won, neither the Israelis nor the United States would put up with that outcome. And so they engineered a coup against Hamas in the West Bank. They tried to dislodge it from Gaza as well, but they failed. Often in Western reporting, it is said that Hamas somehow illegitimately came to power in Gaza, but it's not true. It was elected to office. And as a result of Hamas's political win in 2006 and the inability to dislodge it in 2007, the Israelis put a blockade on Gaza. It's not allowed to export almost anything that it makes. Severe restrictions were put on importation into Gaza of cement and even chocolate for children and nutritional material. And those have now fallen by the wayside, but it's been treated as a kind of open-air prison. And Hamas, in response, has brought in small rockets. It's imported some of them, made some of them, which really are more of a psychological annoyance than anything else. They only seldom actually hit anything and have not killed very many Israelis, but they are a source of anxiety to the Israelis in southern Israel near Gaza.
So I recall at the time when Hamas surprised everybody, including Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice, didn't the prior to that, the Bush people, the Clinton people had a lot of people on the ground, a lot of CIA people on the ground, trying to get the Palestinian Authority to get their act together. And my understanding in that election that caught everybody by surprise, where Hamas won, it was largely due to the fact that the PLO was so corrupt that it ran several candidates for every seat because everybody wanted to be a part of the patronage system, whereas the far more disciplined Hamas ran one candidate per seat and as a result won. And my question to you, Juan, is, was anybody on the American side minding the store? I mean, was it because of Bush got rid of all of the people on the ground that actually spoke Arabic? Was that a part of it? Because that's what happened in Iraq.
It's certainly a big part of it is that the Bush administration was simply clueless about the Middle East and insisted nevertheless in rampage about trying to shape it. I am sympathetic to democracy for the Palestinians, but I don't think it was wise to let Hamas run if Hamas victory wouldn't be tolerated. That is to say, you never want to have an election if you're not willing to abide by the outcome of the election. And this is a lesson that should have been learned from Algeria in 1991, which threw the country into civil war, from Iran in 2009, which produced enormous mass protests. If you have an election, you have to let the chips fall where they may. And the Bush administration was foolish to allow Hamas to run if they weren't willing to accept a Hamas victory. The situation has just become more and more horrid over time. I mean, what is the end game here? Can the Israelis really hope to keep 1.7 million people in this kind of jail forever? I mean, they don't have a harbor. Their airport was bombed. They have electricity shortages. Only 10% of their water is drinkable. This is not viable in the long run. The Egyptians now, because of the coup of General Sisi, who has now become president, are also gunning for Hamas, which is a branch distantly of the Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood. And the Brotherhood in Egypt has been overthrown, persecuted, and declared a terrorist organization and banned. And it is rumored that President al-Sisi would very much like to get rid of Hamas from the Gaza Strip as well, seeing it as a security problem for the Egyptian Sinai. So I think the Israeli leadership sees this moment as propitious for, again, attempting, as they did in 2006-07, to put paid to the Hamas movement. But the problem is that even if you could get rid of Hamas, the situation in Gaza is so horrible that it would just throw up some other kind of radical challenge in its stead.
Again, I'm speaking with Juan Cole, a professor of modern Middle Eastern and South Asian history at the University of Michigan and president of the Global Americana Institute. His latest book is The New Arabs, How the Millennial Generation is Changing the Middle East. And he's also the author of the influential blog Informed Comment at juancole.com. But I think, Juan, in your book, The New Arabs, How the Millennial Generation is Changing the Middle East, deals with a more hopeful picture. You know, we started out sort of with me being kind of, you know, mordant about it all because it is so depressing and it continues to be so. And I think every time we talk, we're not talking about something good that's happening in the Middle East. We're talking about something horrible that's happening. But given that the Shia Hezbollah has been tainted by its cooperation with the Assad regime and helping them put down the popular revolt in Syria, and how the Muslim Brotherhood has been tainted and Hamas, as a result, has been isolated, it seems that the Arab countries are finding themselves in an awkward position supporting a cause with no proxy. And, you know, the Palestinian issue has always been a source of domestic leverage for years in the Arab world. And it seems to me what's happening is that the regional Arab powers are now more worried about internal stability than supporting external instability, which has been the MO for some time. And is it possible now that given what's happening in Syria, do you think that the leaders in this region are waking up to the fact that the radicals are out of control and, you know, unless there's some kind of new coalition, if you will, of moderates in this region, you know, the whole place could fall apart?
I think that the elites in Egypt and Syria have been worried about political Islam, about the religious right in their countries for decades. And the Mubarak regime in Egypt repressed the Muslim Brotherhood. And the Ba'ath regime in Syria, you know, killed thousands of Muslim brothers at Hama in 1982 and made it very clear they wouldn't be allowed to operate thereafter. So it seems to me what happened in the past 3.5 years is that those authoritarian elites, which were, nationalist, you can't really say secular, but more secular certainly than the religious right, but nationalist in character, were weakened by the youth revolts, and the Muslim fundamentalist parties saw an opening to challenge them. And in Egypt, they actually came to power in elections, but then the elite found that unpalatable, and the public also didn't feel that they governed very well, the fundamentalists, and so they were overthrown last year this time. And we're back to, in many ways, a policy of nationalists repressing the religious right. In Syria, the regime just was unable to put down the fundamentalists, some of whom have gone very radical and become are offshoots of Al-Qaeda or affiliates of it. But, you know, the policy of the Damascus elite really hasn't changed, which is to crush this thing. And actually, in the past year, they have had some success in taking back Homs and moving up towards Hama, and they're fighting this week in Aleppo. So it's ironic because you have a secular nationalist regime in Damascus, an Arab nationalist regime, which is socialist in character, would have been, you know, happy enough in the company of the East Bloc in the old days in Eastern Europe. The way that it has succeeded in putting down both the more liberal Sunni rebels and the Al-Qaeda offshoots and affiliates has been to draw on the help of Iran, Russia, and Hezbollah. But it has had some success in this regard in the past year.
Well, I guess in many ways, I'm referring to Saudi Arabia when I talk about Arab powers are more worried about internal stability than supporting external instability. It does seem that Hamas is pretty isolated, and certainly Hezbollah has lost its popularity in the Arab world. So do you think there's any way that
In other words, who's got the initiative? The radicals, they're right in that roiling middle of between Iraq and Syria. Obviously, Jordan's extremely vulnerable with radicals now on both its Syrian and its Iraq border. Who's got the initiative, the moderates or the radicals?
Well, and certainly in the past month, the radicals have made advances by allying with discontented Sunni populations in northern and western Iraq to throw off the Shiite government of Baghdad. But from my point of view, you know, as somebody who travels in the region and spent a lot of time there, it's not a matter of radicals and moderates. The government in Baghdad is a coalition of fundamentalist Shiite parties, one of which was founded by Ayatollah Khomeini, and which were routinely called radical all the time the Americans were there. They happened to have won parliamentary elections and to have gained the prime ministership. But in the same parties in the early 1980s were blowing up the U.S. embassy in Kuwait and helping blow up the one in Beirut. So they have, you know, they get called moderate if they cooperate with the United States. It's not a matter of their ideology. And so it is the relatively the sectarian character of the Shiite parties in, that have come to power in Iraq and their unwillingness to reach out across sectarian lines to the Sunni Arabs that has so alienated the Sunnis of Iraq, who are mostly fairly secular-minded nationalist people, that they have been willing to make a coalition with this Al-Qaeda offshoot, ISIS. But it's, you know, in some ways, the people of Mosul are relatively moderate. The government in Baghdad, not necessarily so. So I think the real issue is what, you know, is underlying all of this turmoil. And I think in many ways it is, it's partly a battle over religious and secular identity. The Middle East is making a choice between nationalism and the religious right. And in Egypt, nationalism for the moment has won. It seems to be winning in Syria. It won in Algeria. And in Tunisia, you have a compromise, another compromise in Morocco. But I mean, that's one of the big keynotes that's going on is religious right versus nationalist. And it is true that some parts of the religious right are now on the ropes. They've had successes in northern Iraq, but Hamas had been supported by Iran and Syria. It turned on them and joined with the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt when that party came to power in 2012. And then when the Brotherhood in Egypt was overthrown, Hamas was isolated because it had abandoned its former patrons in Damascus and Tehran. And that's one of the reasons that the Israelis are able to move against it now is because it is so isolated.
Well, but when you talk about the Shiite government of al-Maliki being so fundamentalist, which it clearly is, supported by a fundamentalist regime next door in Iran, but the people that are moving south and now apparently ISIS, the Islamic State as they now prefer to call themselves, are even in the town of Helan, which is 90 kilometers to the south of Baghdad. You know, this Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, who led prayers last Friday at the great mosque in Mosul to the alarm of everybody around, and now apparently the U.S. drones are looking for him to zap him. One of the first things that ISIS did when they took over Mosul was murder all the Sunni clerics, including the mosque's imam, Muhammad al-Mansuri, and having a name, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, that you couldn't be more inflammatory in terms of claiming a Sunni religious mantle, surely. So what's your sense then of the idea of how far has religion been usurped on both the Shia and the Sunni side? It seems extraordinary to me.
Well, religion is a powerful mobilizing device for political and economic purposes, and is being deployed in that way. But personally, I find it a little bit unlikely that this so-called Islamic State of the so-called Caliph Ibrahim has staying power. I think it will be rolled up in Syria, and it has a chance for a longer life in northern and western Iraq, because the Baghdad government is in such disarray and the Iraqi army has collapsed. But that's a short-term prospect. In the long and medium term, I don't think it's acceptable to Iran, even to Saudi Arabia. And mortar shells fell on the Saudi side of the border with Iraq this week, coming from the so-called Islamic State. Turkey, the Kurds, the United States, Russia, you know, they have the whole world against them. And so I don't think they're in a very good position in the medium to long term. But for the moment, they've played on the severe discontent of the people of Mosul and Ramadi and Fallujah and elsewhere in the Sunni Arab areas of Iraq to pose as champions of the Sunni cause against what is seen as an oppressive Iran-backed Shiite fundamentalist government.
Again, I'm speaking with Juan Cole, a professor of modern Middle Eastern and South Asian history at the University of Michigan and president of the Global Americana Institute. His latest book is The New Arabs, How the Millennial Generation is Changing the Middle East. And he's also the author of the influential blog Inform Comment at juancole.com. Well, of course, if, as some have suggested, including Vice President Biden some time ago, along with Leslie Gelb in an op-ed in the New York Times, saying that Iraq should split into three, it seems to be at least splitting into two or three, but the Sunni side doesn't have any oil. So I don't see, along with what you just said, that they're probably eventually going to get rolled up, what the future is for this region, particularly in the context of your more hopeful scenario in your book, The New Arabs.
Yeah. Well, the first thing to say is it does seem that the Kurds are going to secede from Iraq, and the president of Kurdistan has made an announcement of a referendum in a few months. And the obstacle to that course of action had long been the rejection of it by Turkey. But Ankara seems to be making some peace with the idea of an independent Kurdistan in northern Iraq. The Turks have invested heavily in that region. 70% of the investment is coming from Turkey. The Kurds are offering the Turks favorable oil deals on Kirkuk oil now that they have seized province of Kirkuk. And so it seems as though it might happen. The Baghdad government is, of course, furious, and Nouri al-Maliki today gave a very strange speech in which he condemned the Kurds for enabling the al-Qaeda offshoots in the region. With regard to my book and the millennial generation, my argument is the people born in the late 70s through about the year 2000 are distinctive from their elders. I think they're much less riven by these conflicts between the religious right and the nationalists that we see among the Arab baby boomers, the people in their 60s. They're much more urban. They're much more literate. They're wired, they're cosmopolitan, they're hooked into international media. Many of them have worked and lived in Europe or the United States or the Gulf. And so they're cosmopolitan, a lot of them. And they really object to the authoritarian character of governance in the region. And they staged these uprisings in Egypt and Tunisia and Libya and in Yemen. And they got rid of four presidents for life. I think their most important achievement was that the region was going towards a system of inherited rule by new dynasties. So the Mubaraks were going to pass on Egypt to Gamal Mubarak. and the Gaddafis were going to pass it on to save Gaddafi and so forth. And the young people just refused to be inherited like so many sticks of furniture. They have had a lot of successes, which I think are easy to miss. The Egyptian president Sisi, who just was elected in a kind of authoritarian plebiscite, you know, it's a very disappointing outcome for a country that had been trying to move towards democracy. But on the other hand, the new constitution in Egypt does limit Sisi to 2 4-year terms. So, you know, this idea of the president for life has gone by the wayside. In Tunisia, the constitution abolishes internet censorship, and there's been relatively good parliamentary functioning and bargaining in Tunisia, and I think it's night and day from the old dictatorship of Ben Ali, when people were intensively spied on all the time, and no dissent was brooked. So, you know, in Yemen as well, there's been a fair political transition, and there'll be elections next year. So I think, you know, it's easy to get caught up in what's going on in relatively small and out-of-the-way places like Mosul and Gaza, and not see that there really has been a sea change in so many important areas of politics and culture. And these young people, you know, they were 20, 22 when they made these revolutions. It'll be 30 years before they start to take over the political life of these countries. And I think we can expect them to continue to agitate for more personal liberties and for a more open Middle East.
Well, Juan Cole, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Juan Cole, who's a professor of modern Middle Eastern and South Asian history at the University of Michigan and president of the Global Americana Institute. He's the author of Sacred Space and Holy War, The Ayatollahs and Democracy in Iraq, and his latest book just out is The New Arabs, How the Millennial Generation is Changing the Middle East. He's also the author of the blog Inform Comment at juancole.com. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.